And I'd like to bring this meeting of House Education to order. It's 8:10 on Wednesday, March 10th, and President or Representative Keller, Representative Munoz, Representative Book, myself, Chair Seaton, Representative Wilson is not going to be able to make it today. Representative Edgman will be late. He's attending another meeting. Today, we are going to take up House Bill 297, House Bill 367, which is the tax credits for educational contributions. We're going to take up House Bill 350 and House Bill 347. We're going to start at the bottom of the list because there are amendments still being constructed on the others. So we will start with House Bill 347, and this is the first time we've heard this, isn't it? Or no, there's just a second.
Second.
Okay. And so, anyway, will you refamiliarize us with the bill? And we have been joined by Representative Gardner.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Representative Pete Peterson from District 19 in Northeast Anchorage, the Muldoon area. And we did have a short introduction to this bill last Wednesday when several members were gone, headed back east. So we're bringing it back up today. This bill would allow military spouses to take 10 days of unpaid leave when their active duty spouse was home on R&R from a combat zone. And there is a federal Military Leave Act that was passed by Congress, and that allowed for 5 days. But that was dealing with guard and reserves. And so we thought it would only be fitting that we also had similar law available for active duty military. And this would make it, instead of just 5 days, because we've heard from military people that 5 days after you've been gone for a significant amount of time is not very much time. And so we thought 10 days would be more appropriate. And this bill would cover businesses that had 20 employees or more and schools that had 20 teachers or more. We added that amendment to it myself because there are certain school districts here in Alaska that have fairly low enrollments, and we thought it would be a hardship for them to find substitute teachers. If you had a school that only had one or two teachers and one was gone for 10 days, it could create a problem. So that's one of the changes that we have made to the bill. And I'll actually let my aide, Petter, take over from here if you'd like.
Thank you. And would you reintroduce yourself for the record?
For the record, my name is Petter Turland. I'm staff for Representative Peterson. And it was very recently, actually, as of yesterday, they brought to our attention that in 2009, they edited the FMLA, the Federal Medical Leave Act, to include regular forces. And that was the primary concern and was addressed. But we still feel that there's, like, areas that our bill covers that theirs doesn't. HB 347 was written with our Alaskan troops in mind, and as stated in the last hearing from questions from the chair, it is to be interpreted by Alaskan law. Given that point, there's a couple of differences that still remain. We just got this fax, and I'm not sure if the differences that they're saying don't exist or not, because they're claiming that there's no difference. But the Federal Medical Leave Act allows for up to 5 days leave to spend time with a covered military member who is on short-term temporary rest and recuperation leave during deployment. And we feel that 5 days is far too short for a spouse to spend time together after 12 to 18 months in combat. When a soldier is given a leave, they get 15 days, not including travel time, back home. And 5 days with their spouse member during that 15-day period of time, we felt was a little short. And as well, the FMLA applies to businesses larger than 50, whereas HB 347 covers businesses and, with the amendment, school districts of 20 or more employees. And this exemption was in interest of supporting small businesses, but frankly, if it was the families, in the family's best interest, then any employee of any sized employer would be able to take this leave. But that's a logistic impracticality that, like, you have to allow businesses to keep running so that everything's good.
And excuse me, where is that in the bill? Is that section that...
Which section, sir?
That says that if it's to the benefit of the family, the number of personnel in the school is not limited. Isn't that what I just heard you say?
No, sir.
Okay. Sorry. Would you restate what?
Okay. What I was trying to say is that our bill allows for 20. Employers of 20 or fewer, or 19 or fewer, to not be covered by this. Whereas if you have 20 or more, then this bill is enacted. Whereas the Federal Medical Leave Act covers 50 or larger employers of 50 or larger, 50 or more employees. And what I was trying to say is that if we were writing legislation in the family's best interest, and I mean, if ideally, we would be writing it for any person of any working in any business to be able to take that leave time. But we do need to take care of the businesses as well and see to that things can continue to run even when their employees may need to take this time with their spouses.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson.
Thank you.
Again, and this, of course, would not prohibit from a business that had fewer than 20 employees from allowing their employees to take leave. We're just giving them an exemption if in case it would create a hardship for them. So they're not required.
Thank you. Are there questions for the sponsor? Seeing none, and we did. Representative Book.
Through the chair. Oh, I think I just found it. Never mind, I found it. I was just looking for what the language in the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative
Gardner.
Thank you. Do you happen to know why the original act didn't include active duty military? Is that what you said included National Guard? Do you know the rationale?
Well, Representative Gardner, through the chair, I believe it was originally meant to be, the bill was passed because we had, for the first time, been using a large number of Guard and Reserves in an active military role, where in the past they had mostly been doing, two weeks a year full-time and then weekend maneuvers. And so it was a different role for them, and so it was passed, to try to maybe keep families together a little bit.
Thank you.
And I'm just trying to figure out, in the U.S. Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division, fact sheet number 28A on Family Medical Leave Act military family leave entitlements on page 2, it's saying that there's a on about the fifth line, oh, let's see. On that second paragraph where it says qualifying
exigency
leave, covered employer must grant an eligible employee up to a total of 12 work weeks of unpaid leave during a normal established under this. So what is, I mean, we're talking about 10 days in this bill, and this covers 12 work weeks. So it seems like this bill is much more generous than as amended in 2009, actually gives more benefits than the current bill that we have before us. And of course, this was, we just got this last night. I didn't have a chance to study it, unfortunately, before we got to committee. Yeah. But it appears that the 2009 revision, October, I mean, it's only a couple months old, actually grants greater duration of leave than the bill that we have for Alaska. I mean, the bill we have before us. Is that the way you read that as well?
Mr. Chair, it does. I'm not sure exactly what the definition of a qualifying exigency or what's
exigency.
Well, there.
Thank you.
Yeah, and those are identified later in the down the page there, but it includes more than we had talked about because it includes short notice deployments as well, and military events, child care related facilities, financial rest and recuperation, taking up to 5 days of leave to spend with covered military on short term temporary rest and recuperation during deployment, and then post deployment activities. So Representative Keller.
We just received this fax, and it makes me want to ask a question. Probably if you just got the facts, you wouldn't be able to answer, but what I want to put on the table. He says in the second paragraph there, virtually all the concerns raised in the bill had been addressed in the Family and Medical Leave Act, National Defense.
And Representative Keller, would you identify the facts that you're reading from? That we
it looks like this is a fax from Pension Services International. See, it's and it has attached the U.S. Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division amendments.
And I think that
we
this
just
is,
got this. So.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. and was just laid on the table. We just received it, and I think it's you know unfair to the sponsor to be right. You haven't been able to review this either. So, what I'd like to do is if there's further questions to that. Otherwise, what we'd like to do is table this bill until you have a chance to look at that in relationship to the 2009 revision, and then we'll bring the bill back up.
If I could real quick answer that question you asked previously. Qualifying exigency leave allows for taking up to 5 days of leave, whereas ours does 10. The 12 weeks is implied for the other areas, but when they specified in that the qualifying exigencies leave states that only up to 5 days of leave time spent. So that the 10 days is still applicable, and I think the virtually all concerns raised, I think the two places are the 10 days and ours covers businesses of 20 or more, whereas the Federal Medical Leave Act covers 50 or more, but we can definitely review the document if the committee wishes.
Right, and I'm reading that on the fly here as well, and so I want to give you full opportunity to look over that so that we, when we come back, we can discuss it further. We had Representative Gardner, then Representative Keller.
There's another difference, and I don't know if it matters for you, but the federal law says you have, in order to qualify as an employee to take the leave time, you have to have worked for that employer for a year.
Right. Representative Gardner, through the chair, I think it was a minimum of 1,250 hours or something mm-hmm. like that.
And I do believe that ours
does not
have that.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Keller.
Yeah. Having been in business for a lot of years and knowing a lot of business people in the state of Alaska, frankly, I cannot imagine an employer denying leave in this situation. So to me, the bill seems like the heavy hand of government you know, that even if it does go beyond what the federal law does or whatever, it just seems like it's unnecessary. And I, my question would be, is have you run across anybody that has been denied leave? Has there been testimony to that effect? I haven't heard anybody. Maybe there has.
Representative Keller, through the chair, I haven't specifically heard of, personally, no one has contacted me saying that they've had that problem. But I have been told that there has been instances where leave was denied, and I don't know what business it was or where it was. And obviously, you know, I've been a small businessman for many years myself, and so being short-staffed is not only can hurt the business, but it also puts an extra burden on the other employees. So, but we thought by raising the number of employees up to 20 or more, we thought the businesses that had 20 or more employees might be more able to adapt, and it would cause less less of a hardship.
And before we set this bill aside, just so everyone knows, we do have someone from Personal Labor Relations available for questions, but I'd like to hold those off until we get the analysis. But we did have a person that called in to testify, so I'm going to take that testimony since they've made the effort to do it before we put this bill aside. So, Mr. Al, I think it's Al Senior, or Al Tamangi Senior,
yes,
are you there? And I'm sorry if I messed up your name. Would you go ahead and identify yourself for the record and who you represent and proceed with your testimony?
Yes, my name is Al Tamangi Senior. I'm from Anchorage, Alaska. I own Pension Services International, Inc., and I'm representing myself individually speaking today, but I'm also a member of the NFIB. And we took it upon ourselves to research the recent updates on the Family Medical Leave Act of 1993 and found out that, in fact, they were revised in February of 2010 on a law signed by President Obama on October 28th of 2009. And by downloading this information, we found that the previous statistical data that was being used to support the bill was null and void and had been outdated since this time. And so we therefore took it upon ourselves to present that to Mr. DeWitt to further to the member of the committees.
And just to let you know, we do have your facts and analysis before us at this point in time. So we appreciated that.
I would just like to clarify a couple of points without going into any detail. You'll take a look at page number one there where it says employer coverage under fact sheet number 28 as revised in February 2010. It says the FMLA applies to all public agencies, including state, local, federal employers, local education agencies, commas, schools, and private sector employers who employ 50 or more employees in 20 more work weeks in the current or preceding calendar year. And I have to agree with some information I've heard there, you know, today, is that I have polled 110 of my clients, and I have not got one response that they have ever neglected or refused to grant the provisions grant their employees leave when their spouses return home from military service. And quite frankly, what that tells me is that our employers in this state are doing an outstanding job of supporting the spouses and supporting the members of the military. As many of you probably know, that the business community in the last couple of years has donated over $375,000 to maintain services to spouses and families and help them out. So I think the business community has stepped up to the plate, and quite frankly, we are exempt under this act, under 50, and should continue, you know, to be so unless there is some compelling evidence that we can verify to implement this law. And the biggest question is, if we're exempt under federal law, then why do we have to comply to state law? Where this, because ERISA, and a lot of this applies to ERISA also, why should we be involved, have to comply with two sets of laws? And so it really doesn't make any sense, and I would suggest that the committee dispense with the bill and move on to more important things.
And thank you very much for your testimony and faxing. And Representative Gardner has a question.
Thank you, and thank you for your testimony, Mr. Tamani. I have two different questions. One is, when you say that you raised this issue, when you realized after your own research that the federal law had been updated and you raised the issue with Mr. DeWitt, did it occur to you to also notify the sponsor?
I think that I don't work for the sponsors, and I wanted this to go through the aspect of the committee to which it was being addressed. I did speak to Representative Tuck yesterday, and I spoke to him, and I really, that's all the time that I had. So I tried to do the best I could, Ms. Gardner, but I'm sorry, but I have clients, you know, to take care of. I'm a very small business, and we understand where our money comes from.
Okay, thank you. And second question,
and,
if
and
I might,
thank you. And,
Chair?
Second question, Representative Gardner.
There are some differences in number of days off and size of business between the proposed legislation and the federal regulations. And while I understand that you and the members you've polled of the FNIB or your own group, I'm not sure which, are already complying, and I believe very generously, in large measure, that Alaskan businesses do support military and military families. But if you're already in compliance, then why would there be an objection to just having it in law for those few businesses, even if they're just a handful, but critically important to the family who might be denied leave? Maybe a business that's not part of your membership of the NFIB. So,
well, ma'am, like I say, I polled about 100 and some of my clients, and many, many of whom are not members of the NFIB. And I have not, nor have they, heard of or recognized it to be a problem. So my question is why do you want to regulate something that apparently there's no evidence to support it's a problem? I guess I'm asking you that question.
Well, through the chair? Never mind.
No, this is not a debate between testifiers. If we have questions for them, we can ask them. Were there any further questions for? Thank you very much, and thank you for your work in informing the committee. And we appreciate that. And we have one other person that was in, Rick Davidge. Are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Rick Davidge, State President of Vietnam Veterans of America and Chairman of the Alaska Veterans Foundation. I testified at the last hearing. I, too, received this fax from the sponsor yesterday. Really haven't had a chance to fully understand the implications of it, but do see two significant differences. This bill would extend this to employers of 20 or more as opposed to 50 or more in the federal law, and it would grant up to 10 days leave without pay as opposed to 5. As a combat veteran, I can tell you getting a spouse together with somebody who's been in combat for 12 to 18 months takes a little bit more time than 5 days to sort of put that back together. But we're interested in the amendments. We've discussed it with the sponsor. We support the two amendments that they were offering, but look forward to the next hearing.
Okay, and thank you, and thank you for your previous testimony, and if you have a chance to analyze the differences between those, that would be appreciated as well. So we have anybody else in the room? We have any bells online? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony, and we'll set the bill aside for now. And thank you very much for coming and presenting. And sorry, we got information at the last minute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks, members of the committee.
Thank you. Let's... let's take a brief at ease. At this time, take up House Bill 297, which is the University Scholarship. And we have Mr. Jeans with us.
Did we have number one?
You already adopted the number one.
Oh, okay, so they got redone. Welcome, Mr. Jeans. We had two sets of questions that were forwarded to the commissioner to address, and I'm looking. Lost paperwork here.
Drowning in it.
Yeah, we'll take a brief at ease while we organize our paperwork again. Back on the record, and wanted to ask for sure, we did adopt version R. Is that correct?
We adopted version R, Mr. Chair, and we amended it with number one.
And we amended with number one. So, thank you. We had some questions that the whole committee received that were sent to the department for answering. One of those was on page 9, line 27. If the committee will take a look at that. And we are talking about where it's on, under subsection 4, where it says meets other minimum qualifications to apply or continue to be eligible for the Governor's Performance Scholarship. And I want to make sure that we have a full understanding of what the words or continue to be eligible mean in all its parameters, so that those are narrowed to what the department intends on the record, or expanded to what they intend.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Eddie Jeans. I'm the Director of School Finance for the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. Mr. Chairman, the term there, or continue to be eligible, refers to a student that once they've received a scholarship and they're in their post-secondary program, there's minimum levels of GPA that they must maintain to continue with their eligibility under the scholarship program. It is the department's intention that, and understanding that, post-secondary commission will adopt regulations that are in alignment with other financial aid programs for continuing eligibility. So it's mainly it's looking at a minimum grade point average. It's my understanding that the individual universities typically set those for a continuing eligibility. And so that's what we're referring to there, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, and for committee discussion on this, I think that this is unclear to students what it means. Perhaps it'll all be fleshed out. If the committee is comfortable with that or continue to be eligible, it's fine. It was confusing to me. I think that there were some continue to be a student in good standing or something else, so that it's very clear what we're saying is going to be in that continue to be eligible.
Mr. Chairman, Stephanie Butler from the Post-Secondary Commission is here as well, but it's my understanding that we couldn't even say like a minimum 2.5 grade point average, because some universities have a 2.0 minimum grade point average to maintain eligibility. It's my understanding that when students get their scholarship, that will all be explained to them as part of their continuing eligibility requirements. It's the way it is under the current system right now under other loan programs.
Representative Gardner.
Does that mean that the continuing eligibility standard for a student at one school will be different from another, even though the scholarship they're using is the GPS?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, that's my understanding. It may be a little bit different, but I don't think the differences are that large.
And I guess this is qualifications of all applicants, I think, in both programs. I'm not sure if we have a VOTEC program that it's going to have a GPA. Who was available from the commission?
Stephanie Butler's.
Could she come forward as well? Thank you. Would you introduce yourself for the record and help us out?
Good morning. For the record, Stephanie Butler, Director of Operations for the Commission on Post-Secondary Education. And typically, ongoing eligibility for any financial aid program includes verification with the institution that the student remains enrolled and remains in satisfactory progress. And the definition of satisfactory progress may vary from institution to institution depending on the program the student is enrolled in. For example, at a Voc Ed institution, satisfactory academic progress may require that the student complete a certain number of hours each period, and in a collegiate institution, it may be a little bit different.
Okay, and so just the words continue to be eligible, satisfies that for you, or does it make any difference to continue to be making satisfactory progress towards their certificate? Is that what we're talking about?
Continue to be eligible would be the preferred language here, because it will also encompass verifying that the student is enrolled, that the student has not received other aid in excess of costs of attendance and things beyond satisfactory academic progress.
And are we at any... We want to fully understand what those parameters are going to be. I mean, we could be looking, and we don't know what you do. And I guess if someone gets a academic scholarship, does that mean they're going to have, could it mean that you determine that they have to maintain that same level of grades in a post-secondary institution to continue that scholarship?
No, sir, that would not be correct. If what we'll be verifying with the institution is that the student continues to meet the institution standards for enrollment in that program.
Okay, I just want this very clear on the record that what continue to be eligible does not relate back to the performance standards that they qualified under, whether there were an A, B, or the C-plus grade point averages, and those have any relationship to the post-secondary, that this is maintaining eligibility to continue in the program in which they're enrolled. And I'd just like verbal verification that my
Mr.
statement
Chairman,
is how you understand it as
Mr.
well.
Mr. Chairman, this is Eddie Jeans. I can assure you that is not the intent of that piece of language there, that it is not tied to the level of academic scholarship that the student is awarded. It's simply a continuation eligibility criteria once they're in the post-secondary institution.
Okay. Everybody clear with that and have good understanding? Thank you. That was one thing that I have been wrestling with that I haven't been able to figure out. Very good. Let's go to, I think you have a, you have a packet of amendments. Let's start through these. We have amendment number 2, and I'll offer that one. That was off the questions that we asked the commissioner. And that is to page line 26, after the word include, add two additional years if, and then on line 26, deleting the words time while. So we're on page 9, line 26, and would you object to that? I'd like to offer amendment number 2.
Object for purposes of discussion.
And Representative Munoz has objected for discussion. And let's see, where are we? And this was a question that we asked about military service, and it's unclear whether somebody could go in for a career of military service, be in for 20 years, and then qualify for 6 additional years. And so we wanted to have some credit there or some ability for someone that goes into military service. This is a 6-year program that would extend it to an additional 2. If someone goes into military service, that would give 8 years, but wouldn't be an
perpetuity.
In perpetuity, or something that we couldn't calculate, an indeterminate fiscal note that would be something we would have to be holding on kind of the books for 20 years. So that's the intent of that. Are there any questions, any discussion? Representative Keller.
Sounds good. I was wondering if we could hear from the department and see how they... what they feel about this.
Mr. Jeans?
To the chair, Representative Keller, we're fine with that amendment. Thank you.
Are there further questions on amendment? Representative Boop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this doesn't impact this legislation anywhere else in the bill. There's no other mention of time or anything like that, that this comes up again. It has to be adjusted according to this amendment.
Through the chair, Representative Boop, I don't believe so. This is the reference to the time allotment for the military service.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Representative Book, in relation to that, what I would like to do is go back and offer that as a conceptual amendment, because we do have 2 different scholarship provisions, and sometime we may pick up in one and not in the other. So I'd like to offer that as a conceptual amendment that would recur in the bill if the same provision occurs elsewhere. Is there any objection to that being changed to conceptual? Seeing none, that amendment is offered as amendment number 2. And Representative Munoz?
I remove my objection.
So conceptual amendment number 2 is adopted. And now we have conceptual number 3, which is page 5, line 16. And page 7, line 6. And that's deleting all of section 4. And we have a And I'll offer a conceptual amendment number three.
Object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you. And so we have conceptual amendment number three, deleting section four from the bill. And we have a letter here from Diane Behrens that is asking us to do that as well. The interpretation of this is that the administration of the program could be thrown onto them, where it should be in somebody else's bailiwick. Does the administration have the Department of Education or the Post-Secondary Education Commission having?
Clarification?
Yes.
Did you mean line six on page seven? Line 27, maybe.
Oh. Thank you. I take that as a friendly amendment, so that is going through page 7, line 27, not line 6. Is there any objection to that? Adopted as a friendly amendment. So the amendment will now read page 5, line 16, through page 7, line 27, delete all of section 4. Thank you, Representative Keller. Mr. Jeans.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to defer this to Stephanie.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stephanie, would you?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. The concern here was that the responsibility and authority belongs in the statutes governing the commission's activities, not the corporation's activities. And because the corporation will not have financial responsibility for funding the program, it's actually not appropriate to have that language in the statutes governing the corporation's activities.
Okay. And is there any question that now there's new section that we need to put anything in to direct that new statutory reference to the commission?
Sir, I believe that the reference needed to the commission statute is already there in 1442.030E amendments.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gardner.
That was my same question, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Representative Munoz?
I withdraw the amendment. I mean, the objection.
Is there any other objection? See none. Conceptual amendment number three, as amended, is adopted. We now have conceptual amendment number four, which I would offer to page 9, line 23, after 6 years, add providing the student maintains Alaska residency. And I offer that amendment. And Munoz?
Object for discussion.
Thank you. And that's on page 9, line 23. And this is a conceptual amendment. So again, where this would occur throughout, we have a six-year qualification, and the question became if someone left the state, took up residency in another state, can they come back and claim, can they claim this, or do they need to maintain their Alaskan residency? That's the question before the committee. Mr. Jeans, does the department have any question on this?
Mr. Chairman, I understand what the amendment does. I guess I may have a little concern that you may have a student that goes out of state, gets their bachelor's, and wants to return to the state to pursue a master's. If they were to give up their Alaska residency for lower tuition out of state, then they would not be able to come back and use their scholarship to pursue their master's. I just put that on the table so you're aware of that. So it will limit students' abilities to come back in state, take advantage of a scholarship that they earned if they give up their Alaska residency.
And of course, going out as a full-time student, they can maintain their permanent fund dividend status and their Alaska residency while they're away in school. If they make the determination they are leaving the state, not maintaining that, don't intend to return. The question is, do we want to have people maintain their Alaska residency. So that's the question that's before the committee, and it's a policy call. Does the commission have any position on that?
No, sir.
Okay. Questions or comments? Seeing none, Representative Munoz?
Withdraw the objection.
Okay, so conceptual number four is adopted. I'd move conceptual amendment number five, which is to page 14, line 10. We're deleting on line 10. Oops. In the wrong spot here.
Page 17. Oops. Mr. Chairman.
And withdraw that. No, I'm just going to modify that amendment so that the amendment is going to read page 17, line 10. And that would delete, comma, or a 5-point scale for advanced placement classes, comma, and it would delete those words. And Representative Munoz?
Object for discussion.
Thank you. Mr. Jeans, would you explain the department?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The department's supportive of this amendment to remove the 5-point scale. It's our intention to adopt regulations that require all districts to use some kind of conversion matrix to a 4.0 scale.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gardner.
Question for Mr. Jeans. Would it not be reasonable to think that doing this would have the unintended consequence of discouraging students from taking AP courses, which are supposed to be college level, are supposed to have a higher workload, and if students are worried about their GPA in order to get the scholarship, I can see a lot of students simply not taking the AP classes.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, we don't believe that it will discourage students from taking the AP classes. The 4.0 scale, grading scale, is intended for the scholarship program only. So districts can continue to use a 5-point scale in awarding credit to students for their transcripts. But for the purpose of calculating eligibility under the scholarship program, we want them to use a uniform scale. In other words, students can still get their 4-plus GPA at the district level.
And Mr. Jeans, I guess that was one of the previous questions that we had was on page 1, where we have the district determination of scholarship eligibility. So you're going to correct me if I'm wrong or verify. The procedure is going to be that the department sets out a matrix qualification. I mean, you are also going to be setting out the curriculum courses and the performance, and so there will be some determination in here for mechanisms for the districts for determining those grade point averages for qualifications, but they'll be uniformly sent to the commission on a 4-point scale. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, they will be. What the districts do is verify the eligibility level, so we will require through the regulatory process that districts utilize a 4-point grading scale to determine eligibility. That information will be transmitted to the commission.
And just furthering and asking Representative Gardner's question. So if someone takes an AP class and they're in a district that normally has a 5-point scale, what do you anticipate regulations might look like that for converting that to a 4-point scale?
Mr. Chairman, if it's a 5-point scale and the student got an A, I would say they are going to get a 4-point on their, for the purposes of the GPS. Yet on their transcript, it would still be reflected as a 5-point award for taking that AP class.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions? Does the commission have any position on this amendment?
No, sir.
Okay, thank you. Representative Munoz.
Withdraw objection.
Okay. I object still, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner, do you want to speak to your objection? Yes,
I do. I'm thinking of the student who's taking the fourth year of English. Maybe it's a senior who says, I can take any of the available English classes, or I can take AP English, which is college credit. I'm confident I can get an A in all the other English classes. AP English is really tough, and I might get a B there. It's going to affect my GPA adversely, potentially, you know, knocking me out of the highest level, potentially. And so I'm not going to take AP. And I think that can happen a lot. And what this bill is about, and we can't say it often enough, is not about giving kids money for college. It's not. It's about trying to engage students in making choices for the highest rigor. And I think that this amendment reduces that. And I'm just going to fight anything that does, because for me, it's about rigor and it's about excellence in education. And this discourages kids from reaching as high as they might otherwise.
Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll take an opposing view. I think that given the opportunity for some student to have access to those classes isn't reduced by this amendment, and that if somebody has the aspiration of going to academic channels, as you will, that they're going to pursue that. If they're going to look at an avocation that's outside of the state in an opportunity where they're looking at a different college level other than that in Alaska, this does not remove that opportunity to take those classes where they're available, which is a very finite place if you look at the overall locale in the state of Alaska. It means that within two confines of where we deal, Fairbanks and Anchorage. So that leaves the rest of the state out as far as standardization. And that's why I'm going to hold my, maintain my affirmation of this amendment.
Okay, Representative Keller Munoz.
I just, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to ask the department if that is accurate, Representative Gardner's fear. I'm not saying definitively, but is that possible that it would reduce the incentive to take higher level courses that have the
through the chair, Representative Keller, I clearly understand Representative Gardner's concern, but I think you have to go back to the beginning of the bill and look at the grade point averages and the cuts that we placed in the bill. We started at 3.5 or higher to qualify for the highest tier. So if a student goes all the way through high school and has one AP class and gets a B in it, they're still going to qualify for the highest tier. Is it possible that somebody could, through taking a number of AP courses, fall down to a lower tier? Absolutely. But I can't tell you where that line is or how many courses they have to take. But it is possible.
Thank you.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Isn't it true, too, that with successful successful completion of the course and the exam, the AP exam, that the student is eligible for up to 6 units per course at a qualifying university? Is that still the case? That was the way it was when I went to school. So there is a great incentive to take the AP course because they get the free credits transferable anyway if they pass the exam. And I think that's still the case.
And I think that we just distributed to the committee one of the ESC clips that was talking about AP courses and having to take that exam versus taking dual credit courses and trying to balance those. But yes, that was the big incentive for taking an AP course is you can actually if you pass that the AP exam, then you and depending upon what level you pass it at and what institution you're going to, as to whether it's a 2, 3, 4, or 5 of what they accept for the credit, then you get college credit for that. So, yeah, there's very definitely additional benefits for taking AP classes. So is there further discussion? The question is on passing conceptual amendment number 5.
Conceptual amendment number 5 to CSHB 297, Representative Munoz.
Yes.
Representative Wilson is absent. Representative Edgemond is absent. Representative Keller.
Yes.
Representative Booth.
Yes.
Representative Garden.
No.
I have 3 yeas, 1 nay.
Don't forget me.
Don't forget
me. I'm sorry. Chair Seaton.
Yes. It's been one of those days, let me tell you. Not only for me, thank goodness. That was the first packet of amendments that we had. Do we have did everybody get the discussion paper from the Commissioner of Education back on the questions that I asked the about this version R, about district eligibility, the districts will, how they determine eligibility, and who's going to set the criteria and all those things. But what we will do is we'll have those questions forwarded with the bill. So if there's further clarification, that will be in those questions will be in the record. And Representative Gardner also on 3-9 sent some questions in, and Representative Gardner, would you like to address any of those?
Yes, items? I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to ask Mr. Jeans about my first question, number 1, page 9, lines 16 to 21. And what I'm concerned about is a student who maybe leaves Alaska because of the parent in the military, who maybe doesn't attend high school here at all, and under this provision would be eligible for the GPS program. And is that, I mean, maybe what if the child leaves in first grade and goes to a school someplace else and then claims this because the parent's been active duty military the entire time? Is that the intention? Because, yeah.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, that is not the intention. The intention here is if a student is starting their high school career in Alaska on track to be awarded a GPS scholarship, yet the parent gets redeployed somewhere else and the student has to go, that they have an opportunity to complete that program.
Thank you. And how would you feel about an amendment that says they have to complete at least 2 years of their high school career in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I know that we intended to address that issue through the State Board of Education, through the regulations, through that process. I can't say that I'm for or against a 2-year insertion at this point.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer a conceptual amendment.
Thank you. Representative Gardner.
And it simply would say in this section, which is page 9 again, section B, line 16 through 21, that this, in parallel with the amendment you previously offered about an extension for 2 years if they're military service up to 2 years, I would like to have a conceptual amendment that says that the student would have to have spent at least 2 years of high school credit from Alaska.
Okay, so this is going to be, let me just get it down here. This is conceptual amendment number 6, and basically line 20 after the word who has completed at least 2 years of high school in Alaska.
Yes.
And that's conceptual, so it'll go in the correct spot. And thank you, and I'll object to the amendment for discussion. That was also one of the questions that I asked, and that's on page 2 of my questions. And because we weren't sure what that meant, because I was in the same position of saying that could have been somebody that was here, and it's the parents who have left, so they could, actually the child might not even ever attend school in Alaska and could be eligible for that, and I didn't think that was the intention. And the commissioner actually said, for the purposes of the subparagraph, allowable circumstances include a circumstance in which a high school student who is eligible left the state. So they're meaning exactly what you meaning, that the student was a student in high school here. Mm-hmm. And although they don't have the 2 years listed in there, that seems to be a reasonable consideration to me. So that's that was just my statement. We have somebody behind you. Is that with the are you with the department? I forget. Oh, okay. Oh, sorry. Our drafter. could you come up as well? Representative Keller. Sorry, Gene.
I was wondering about, I can see this one going to court, you know, because of the resident requirements to be different 2 years, you know, setting that standard. I mean, just like we've been in court in the past, and I bet you that's what our legal officer, I jumped right in here, but maybe I'll withdraw my question.
Jean Michelle, would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record?
Yeah, hi, Jean Michelle with Legislative Legal Services. I just wanted to point out that because of the structure of this bill, you can't always find the eligibility criteria in the places you're looking. The amendment would only address the extension of time for the scholarship usage. And what I think Representative Gardner is concerned about is initial eligibility, which is provided for in on page 9 in one of the places in this bill. Page 9, lines 8 through 21, and in that provision, there's already a requirement of Alaska residency and graduation from high school in this state. So if you amend the extension of time provision, it will be inconsistent with this. I think the amendment would actually have the opposite effect of what you're trying to accomplish, which is to allow an extension of time after only attending high school in the state for 2 years, but all applicants still have to meet this eligibility criterion, whether they're military or not.
And thank you, Ms. Michelle, but I think that what we're worried about is there's this exemption that we're talking about that says a high school student who is an Alaska resident, that could be a student that parent is in the military and left and has been gone for 8 years and maintains their
I'm sorry, I was looking at the extension of time provision. I guess that could be read to allow a non-high school student to attend.
That's what I read it that way as well, providing a window in there for a non-high school student, just as long as a parent maintained an allowable absence eligibility for any reason. I mean, that would mean that person would. So, Gene, before you leave. Do you understand what we are trying to accomplish there?
Yeah, I was on the award provision. I apologize for that. But, yeah, I agree that that could be interpreted, although I don't think that was the purpose of that exemption. Probably could be interpreted to apply to non-high school attendees.
Right. And so the question is, to put that in there, who has attended an Alaska high school? Or who has attended at least 2 years in Alaska high school. Do you, Representative Keller thought if we put in a 2-year qualification there, that might get us in trouble? That might get us in a legal, oops. Representative Keller was expressing the opinion that having a 2-year in there might get us in problem. Do you think that that's true, requiring 2 years of high school participation in Alaska, or that do you think we would have a legal challenge to that?
Representative Seaton, no, I don't believe so, because it's these are not similarly situated individuals. I there's a possible argument to be made because everybody else has to graduate from the high school, but you already have that issue in this bill, where you could essentially exclude them from attending high school in the state, and adding a two-year requirement would actually be a little more it would be safer than leaving it open-ended.
Okay.
From an equal protection standpoint.
Good. Representative Keller, and
I just this is probably to the maker of the amendment, but there's several thoughts going through my mind. Is I'm wondering if it's really a bad thing to entice the cream of the crop from outside to come up here and get in our post-secondary education system. And I was wondering if the this one's directed the same idea to the department, but I would assume that you would still make regulations on this section that would put in things like comparison of so we know that the GPA is somehow you know, qualification would be met if a student came in from outside. And I mean, I know the SAT or whatever the cut score is going to be would be the same. That'd be easy. But what about comparing GPAs in the curriculum?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, districts already have to evaluate a student's transcript when they transfer into the state of Alaska. So they're going to have to go through that process anyway. What this amendment would do is say a student has to have spent at least 2 years in high school in Alaska to qualify for the scholarship program if you leave the state, okay? So you're talking a student has to spend at least their freshman, sophomore, or sophomore, junior years in Alaska, and then get transferred out of state for their junior or senior year. Okay, that's what this amendment does. It says we're only going to give you that break for a possible 2 year period. Students can transfer to Alaska in their senior year and qualify for the GPS program. They may not have all the course requirements that our program requires, but then that's going to be up to them to figure out how to get there, you know, if they want to participate in our program. But this section here doesn't prohibit anybody from coming into our state and taking advantage of the scholarship program.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. But you testified earlier that there will be regulations about who qualifies under this provision, and I, my point on the amendment is simply that we have a policy call. Is it 1 day in high school here, 1 semester, 1 year, or 2 years? And that's something that I think is legitimate for the committee to make.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I agree with you. What you're doing is setting the policy in statute as opposed through a regulatory process.
Thank you.
Representative Boo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm still hung up on my colleague's inquiry regarding discrimination. By establishing this, I'm not challenging your expertise, but it would seem to me that it's fairly clear that that's what we're establishing. So I'm just looking for clarity, and I'm not going to oppose the amendment.
Representative Book, I think the thing is that we are giving an exemption here, because what we're doing is we're saying you have to graduate from Alaska High School.
Okay.
However, if you've spent 2 years here and you transfer out in a military family, we're going to still let you qualify.
Right.
That's what this is. This is allowing an exemption on this portion. So it's saying that you didn't have to graduate, be your senior year and graduate from high school here. We're allowing you for that military parent's military service to graduate from another school as long as you took the core curriculum and as long as you took at least 2 years of high school in Alaska.
And graduated.
Yeah.
From high school.
And graduated from high school. fulfill all the minimum requirements. And I objected, I believe, to conceptual amendment number 6, and I believe our attorney well understands our meaning of this conceptual amendment. Okay. And so I'll remove my objection. Is there a further objection to amendment number 6? Conceptual amendment number 6 offered to page 9, line 16 through 21. Seeing no further objection, conceptual amendment number 6 is adopted. Further discussions. Representative Gardner, did you have another on your...
Should I? I think I'm covered. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm comfortable with the rest.
You're comfortable with the rest. Okay. And Representative Gardner, I think you and I covered a number of those. Do you... were there any parts of those questions that you feel weren't answered in the responses that I gave, that I had in mind?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for asking that question. I actually do have another issue, and I'm not sure what the committee might want to do about it, but refers to my question number 3 about eligibility for an academic scholarship, and early in the discussion about this bill, I was thinking about a student who perhaps as a freshman in high school isn't yet serious about their future and maybe slacks off and then matures and wants to says, okay, I can really do this and I'm going to go for it. And I was worried about a student who maybe lacks a fourth year of math by the senior year. And I thought I had asked the commissioner on the record, could that student between May of the senior year and college complete that requirement in a summer school class or something like that, maybe even at the university to complete the fourth year? And I understood at that time that the answer was yes. But the student will already have graduated, potentially, but didn't meet the qualifications. So that's the question I was trying to get at with number 3. And I'm not certain that the answer really says what I thought I had understood. The alternative pathway applies only to students who fail to meet the qualifications for circumstances outside of their control. This isn't exactly, unless you just say an immature student, that's outside of their control. That could apply to a lot of people all along the way. And otherwise, students need to get busy in high school. Yes, we absolutely want students. That's the point of the whole legislation. But nevertheless, there will be students who are a little bit laggard and who still can meet the qualifications if they could take, if they can do it perhaps in the summer. So, am I correct in remembering that the answer previously was yes, or do they have to do it before they graduate?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I believe the answer is still yes, because when you look at 1443.830, it doesn't just refer to an alternative pathway, but also a makeup procedure. So, and I think the commissioner is looking for the maximum flexibility to provide students here that, maybe they don't pass all 4 years of math. There would be an opportunity for them to make that up somehow through an alternative pathway approved by the department.
Representative Gardner.
Just to be abundantly certain, even if the deficit was not caused by circumstances beyond the student's control? Because that's the first sentence of that section.
And Representative Gardner, and we do have the commissioner with us now, but that was not my understanding that you could then later take courses. I thought it was you're going to understand this ahead of time. You can take a night course. You can take a between your junior and your senior year, you can take a course some other time. You can take a virtual course, but it seems like this would be pretty open-ended into the time frame in which that could be allowed, and I thought that we were saying that people needed to make their educational plans and do them. If they didn't want to graduate, they could wait and not graduate until after, and they wouldn't have to graduate if they didn't want to.
Mr. Chair, that was exactly my next question.
Yes.
What are the options?
Because I think you have to apply for graduation. The department is...
Mr. Chairman, the x-ray eyes are burning through the back of my head.
Okay, good.
I misspoke.
Oh,
and
okay.
So your understanding is correct, that if a student had the opportunity, did not, then they are out of luck.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Gardner.
Is it correct that a student has to apply to graduate? So somebody who's met the requirements for graduation but not met the requirements for the scholarship could simply not apply to graduate until they've met the scholarship requirements?
We have the commissioner back there choking.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, the high school graduation requirements are different than the scholarship program. So a student could meet the graduation requirements, could even not pass the high school qualifying exam and still be issued a certificate of attendance. So that the completion of high school isn't directly tied to the scholarship program. The academic rigor in the scholarship program is much higher than what's required to receive a high school diploma. So you can't opt out of not getting a diploma when you meet the graduation requirements.
Okay, that's the question. Yeah. You can't. You have to graduate if you've met the requirements.
You've met the requirements, you graduate. Year?
Well, I think we need the commissioner to come up, because if someone has met their minimum requirements to graduate from high school as they, in their first semester of their senior year, they don't have to graduate. They have to apply for early graduation. We don't automatically, I don't think. Mr. Commissioner, you're hearing our discussion. And you've also been in the status, I'm sure, where you were dealing with graduation. Can you let us know what the policies are?
Thank you, Chair Seaton. For the record, my name is Larry Ledoux. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Education and Early Development. The graduation at the end of 4 years is our goal, and students who meet the requirements graduate. Districts do not let them stay around. There have been instances in the state, very rare, where students will not pass a required subject, because at one point in time you could get a fifth year of eligibility for sports. Sort of a strange kind of redshirting. But I don't believe that that's allowed anymore. So when students graduate, they graduate. Now, if you finish your requirements early, then you do apply to graduate, because it's not the norm. And the application is not really an application. You sit down with your counselor, usually at the start of your junior or senior year, because for a student to earn the 22 or 23 credits necessary to graduate, you have to work hard, take early classes, take virtual or distance courseware. So it's no surprise to anybody when they graduate, and it's just you've met the requirements and you graduate. Usually, though, even when you graduate and meet the requirements at semester, you may go off to college, but many of them come back to walk with their class. So, and districts also wouldn't receive funding for somebody who met all the requirements just to hang around. So the idea that a student wouldn't graduate on purpose to get a scholarship, I don't believe is going to happen. It's not the way kids think. Those of you who have teenagers know it's very difficult even to get them to sit down to fill out the scholarship application, you know, much less think that way.
Thank you. So we're talking about a extremely rare circumstance, we think.
Okay.
And
let it go.
I have on page 12, line 16. Yeah, page 12, line 16, starting in there. We have the words very high and require very high academic achievement in the second tier and require high academic achievement. And we have on line 18, require moderate academic achievement. I think that we are mixing these things, the maximum award sections, we're mixing in the requirement sections, which are in a different section, and I would like to find out whether we can remove those. Yeah.
Page.
Oh, page 12. On line 16 is where you...
Mr. Chairman?
And I think that these tiers have been identified previously, and I'm not sure why we're putting them in here in different language and whether it's necessary to reinsert these in here where we're talking about the tiers of, because I think we've identified those, and those tiers is what the tiers are under the GPA standards and the test standards, and it seems like we're mixing two things together. Commissioner?
Chair Seaton, without having a chance to really look at it, it appears that it may be confusing. We're not intending to create, you know, any confusion, and we'll take a close look at that.
Okay, and the comments that I'm refreshing your memory from your to us were the comments very high and moderate are editorial references to the academic tiers for the initial GPS eligibility is what you said, and I understand that they're there, but I just and maybe Jean Michelle, we need her to come back up and let us know whether we need those things in there to identify, or are the tiers already identified previously and under on page 10 lines 20 through 27 as A, B, and C are, you know, with the grade point averages and everything, and so we're introducing a new concept here that is not, those things aren't defined in the definitions, and so I'm wondering if we need that new language in there without any real definitions or relations back. I think it's confusing.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there's two purposes for those tiers, and I agree that it's confusing. And there are other ways to draft it, but you would need some form of distinction for the awards themselves, because you've got set percentages in that paragraph one based upon the tiers that correlate not just to the grade tiers, but also to the test scores. So I would like to see more consistency in the language used. But there would have to be some kind of distinction made in the award section on page 12 for the level of scholarship that's awarded based that correlates to both the test, the minimum test score and the minimum grade that a student receives under the eligibility criterion on page 10 and pages 10 and 11, depending on the scholarship.
Mr. Chairman,
receive.
Reverend Boot.
If I might offer a word exchange, the word recognition instead of achievement, so that you're not looking at the result of the student's activity, but rather the department's observations, so that you're not.
Well, Representative Book, what I'd like to do is relate back to page 10, starting on line 20.
Okay.
And page 10, line 20 is talking about the three tiers of academic scholarship. Mm-hmm. And it's got an A average tier, a B average tier, and a C average tier. And then over here, we're substituting different words for, you know, very high academic achievement, and we're presuming that's A average tier, but it doesn't have the same name. I don't care if we call it platinum, gold, and silver, whether we call it whatever, but I would like it To be consistent and defined in the bill, and we've defined A average tier, B average tier, and the C average tier, but we haven't defined these three terms that we've incorporated here. So that's we talked about the first tier and a second tier and a third. We've talked about the highest tier. Mr. James.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the language is all right the way it is, and let me try and help you with that. First of all, in the purpose of the program, back on page 8 at the top, on line 6, it says the academic scholarship consists of three levels of award. Page 8, I'm sorry, line 6.
Page. Yes.
So we're talking about three levels of award here. When you go to page 10, we start describing the criteria for the academic scholarship, which has the grade point average, the student's assessment score, or their test score, and then what was the other one?
The curriculum.
So you have to meet the criteria, those three criteria, for a level of award. And then we go into the on page 12 where you're describing the levels of award. So the maximum award is 100%, and then the second level per se would be 75% of the maximum. So I think the language is all right, because we're referring to tiers, and we're talking about eligibility within those, how to qualify for those tiers on page 10, and then the award section tells us what level of award you're going to receive for each tier.
And I agree, but when we're talking about three levels of awards, and then we're talking, I mean, it seems like we need some name or some consistency, so when we refer to three levels of awards, you know, we could say what those are. We need something. I mean, it's not that we have to. I mean, it's okay, but it just seems to me that it should be set out in a more clear fashion, and it's only wording. It's not legality that I am worried about.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, I understand that, but I guess I would caution you on using the ABC, because those are eligibility criteria. And then when you look at the assessment score, you may have qualified for the highest tier on the grade point, but on the assessment score, you qualify for a lower level. So you're not going to get the highest tier based on your GPA. You're going to get the highest tier of what you qualify at the lowest level of those three eligibility criteria.
But I mean, the problem is we're calling it an A average tier. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it's a B.
Well, we're calling it an A average tier, but then we're not calling it an A average tier anyplace else.
I can work on that language.
Would you? Mm-hmm. And I don't have a conceptual amendment to do it. I'm just saying that we need to coordinate that across so that it will be clear to everybody. The one other thing that I had was that on page 12, line 29, this says that a part-time student who receives a merit-based scholarship and is enrolled at least half-time is eligible for an award on a pro rata basis. As you see on the response that we got back from the administration, it's at the maximum award for half-time student. Well, first of all, it says subject to the half-time cap noted below, students are awarded scholarship funds based on their cost of attendance for between 6 and 11 credits, and the maximum award for a half-time student could qualify as 50% of the maximum applicable to their tier, which means that we really don't have a pro rata based on the credit hours you're taking. It's a a half-time student can qualify for one half of the tier, is what I believe. But I think when we say pro rata, we're going to get into a dispute, because we're saying a half-time student is anything between 6 and 11. So you have to get, you get 50% at 6, but then your pro rata between there and a full-time student is what I would interpret pro rata to mean. And so I think we want to clear that up, if the intention is, if you are between 6 and 11 credits, you get half of the award, then I think we should just say that. And unless you're meaning that there is going to be a true pro rata based on the percentages.
Chair Seaton, I think that we can clarify that. I think that you're correct. Pro rata to many would be, you know, payment based on the credit, and that's not our intent.
Okay. And so I would like to adopt a conceptual amendment so that Gene can incorporate that. It would be a conceptual amendment number 7, that on page 12, line 19, pro rata will be defined as half-time student receives half of the award that they qualify for.
You said
as a full-time student.
Line 29.
Did I say line?
You said 19.
Oops. Sorry. Yes, this is line 29. I'll correct myself on conceptual amendment number 7. That would be line 29. And we will change the wording from pro rata basis to a half-time student may receive one half of the eligible tier award, or the tier award that they're eligible for, however you're going to write that up.
I have a question.
And I'll offer that amendment, and Representative Munoz object for...
Object, but I have a question.
Yes.
A part-time student in a post-secondary or at the secondary level?
This is at the post-secondary level.
Okay.
This is when they're in attendance at a post-secondary institution. If they're less than half-time, they can't receive any. If they're half-time, which is 11, or at a college situation, is 6 through 11
okay.
credits. And if they're above that, they receive the full scholarship.
Maybe more. Okay.
Are there any questions? Representative Munoz?
I withdraw the objection.
Okay, and I guess I only have one other question, and that is on page 15, lines 3 and 4. And the question that I had asked the commissioner was, I wanted to get a firm decision on the record that this deficit was caused by rare and unusual circumstances outside the control of the student. I want to put on the record a couple of different scenarios there, and also what it does not include, because I asked whether that includes special needs, accommodations, or anything like that. And so if you would answer those questions for us just on the record so we understand that.
Chair Seaton, students who have an IEP, if it includes information in their IEP that they have certain accommodations for testing, those are part of the IEP. And the SAT, ACT would offer accommodations to special ed students. But this does not refer to, is not designed for special ed students, and it's not referring to students with IEPs. This is just the deficit was caused by a rare and unusual circumstance outside the control of the student. Perhaps I could give you any kind of disaster scenarios that occurred, and I think we would look at those cases individually. And I'd like to say that I believe that's the strength of this bill, is that many pieces of legislation are just this or that. This one recognizes that all students are different and provides a pathway for us to look at those individual circumstances.
Okay, thank you. Representative Keller.
Yeah, part of the process that we've gone through with this bill, I've been gone. I would just like a clarification, reiteration of homeschool students and how they fit in to this process, please.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, homeschool students are fully participatory in this program. We would expect them to meet the same requirements as any student, and they perform well. We would expect the parents to have an evaluation system of their student and to explain it to us. We would expect the students to achieve the same score on a achievement test that any other student, and we would expect their transcript or work history to show a history or show evidence that they achieved a rigorous curriculum. And same standard, and we think it'll work very well whether they're a homeschool student in a state program or not.
Follow up,
Reverend.
Just for the record, the private school, if a student graduates from a private school in the district, it's still up to the public school administration to determine the eligibility for a graduate from a private school, right? The way this is set up?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, private school students would be fully eligible as public school students in the state of Alaska would be expected to meet the same requirements as any student.
And one more
follow-up, Representative Keller.
One of those requirements would not be graduating from a public school. It could be graduation from a private school, right?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, yes.
Thank you.
Are there further questions or clarifications for the commissioner, for finance, for our alleged legal?
Yes.
Yes. Representative Booth.
Thank you. The process for all these reiterations and amendments and rewriting, we're going to be, through the chair, looking at this again Friday in its entirety.
Our intention, and I hope we can do it, is that we will have a bill that is fully complete with all the amendments integrated into it before, hopefully we can get it Thursday night, so that we can have time to review it in its entirety. And my intention would be to have the committee vote to move out the bill on Friday.
It'll be perfect.
It's going to be perfect. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Let's take a brief at ease. to order, and we have now House Bill 367, Tax Credits for Educational Contributions. And Representative Munoz, would you like to introduce your...
Sure. I would, first of all, like to introduce my staff, Kendra Kloster, who will present the bill. HB 367 allows tax credits for educational contributions to post-secondary institutions, vocational education, and university schools. A current law allows a tax credit of $150,000. This would expand the tax credit to beyond that as a way to encourage further investment in our post-secondary institutions. And Kendra will make an intro, offer an introductory statement, and walk us through the bill.
Representative Munoz, we have a CS before us. Do you want to move that CS?
Yes, I'd like to move CS for House Bill 367, version R.
And I'll object for introduction and discussion. So we have work draft, version. We have version R before us. Kendra, if you want to.
Sure. For the record, Kendra Foster, staff through Representative Kathy Munoz. I'll start off with House Bill 367. It is not a change in policy, but rather an expansion of the existing policy. It will increase higher education tax credits and place a cap on it at 25 million credit per year. At the current time, you can only get up to 150,000 credit per year. And this current limitation of the $150,000 tax credit has a constraining effect on corporate donations and investments in educational and vocational institutions. By expanding the education tax credit, companies and individuals can help Alaska universities expand their existing research and development capacities and help to maximize potential for economic development. Many major employers in Alaska understand the importance of being involved in our universities, and programs such as the new mining programs, which have been implemented in our universities, have been highly supported by companies such as CORE and HECLA, and been recruiting students straight from those programs and putting them into jobs here in Alaska. This bill will create more of an incentive for Alaskan companies to get involved in our higher education and create lasting relationships. And we feel that this is important for them to get involved in. And I kind of move on here to the changes in the CS if we want to look over that.
Go ahead.
Well, I'll talk to the CS real quick. What we're doing is we're going to require the director of insurance, which is there in section one, to give an annual report to the legislature so we can see how this program is working. And the tax credit, the CS is going to work. We're going to do it. It's not drafted up to how we had originally intended. There's a change that needs to be made. What we plan on doing is keeping the first $100,000 contribution at a 50% tax credit, and the second $100,000 contribution will be a 100% tax credit. And then from 200,000 on up, you will get a 50% tax credit, which is capped there at 25 million.
Okay, thank you. And those first two that you said, the first 50% on the first 100,000 and the 100% on the second 100,000, that's existing law, correct?
Correct.
And existing, everything exactly the way it is. Okay, thank you.
And Chairman Seaton, to accomplish 50% over 200,000, we need to offer an amendment to the CS.
Okay, and will is there any objection to adopting the CS? I had an objection. I'm going to remove mine. Is there any further objection? Seeing none, we have the CS before us. And Representative Munoz, would you go ahead and move that conceptual amendment?
I would like to move conceptual amendments to CS HB 367 version R that would allow 50% tax credit for contributions over 200,000.
And thank you. And that is a conceptual amendment that would appear anywhere the tax credit language KERS throughout the different taxes in the bill, as I understand it. And that will be a conceptual amendment number one. And I'll object for discussion just in case anybody, does anyone have any questions on the 50% tax credit for contributions in excess of $200,000? Seeing none, I'll remove my objection. No further objections. Amendment number one is adopted. So we have before us version R as amended. Kendra, did you have further information?
No further comment unless you guys have some questions, but I know we have some folks here in the audience that have been waiting to testify, so I wanted to make sure we give them an opportunity as well. Jim Johnson here from Doyon, I believe, is in the audience, and also online is Joanna Bales from Department of Revenue in case you had any questions as well.
Okay, thank you. Seeing no further questions for the sponsor, thank you. And we will now go to public testimony. We have signed up in the room, Marty Rutherford. No, not on the room, 367. Marty, are you online? And did you wish to testify? Or it's Mary Rutherford, sorry about that.
Actually, it's Mary Rutherford. There's.
Yep, I...
thank you.
Yes, sorry about that. And would you go ahead and identify who you are representing and go ahead with your testimony on House Bill 367.
Thank you. Mary Rutherford. I'm president of the University of Alaska Foundation, and I also serve as the Chief Development Officer for the University of Alaska. I'm pleased today to be here to support this expansion of the current policy. As Kendra noted, the university is always excited to see new opportunities and incentives for fostering closer relationships, and we believe that the tax credit is a tool that has been quite effective for us, and that the expansion of this will help us gain increased support of the university, particularly in areas that are of strategic importance to the state and the university. We've had great success with the fisheries groups, as well as some of the insurance groups fostering support for some of our summer bridging and K-12 outreach programs. So I'm just here today to speak in favor of this, as you've heard it this morning, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Does anyone have any question for Mary Rutherford? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Rutherford. Let's see, do we have Tim Johansson, maybe? Are you? And sorry, it's like a doctor's scroll there for me. I need heavier glasses, I guess. Would you go ahead and identify your...
Sure. Jim Johnson, Chair Seaton. I'm the Senior Vice President of Administration for Doyon Limited, based in Fairbanks, Alaska.
And is that S-O-N or S-E-N?
S-E-N.
S-E-N, that's what... Okay. Thank you. Please proceed with your testimony.
Well, thank you, Chairman Seaton, and thank you, members of the committee. Really appreciate your effort on behalf of increasing business support for higher education, vocational, technical education here in Alaska. I'm here on behalf of Doyon Limited. We are owned by 17,500 Alaska Native shareholders. We own 12.5 million acres of land. By some measures, the largest private landowner in the United States. And we own a number of subsidiary companies, primarily in the oil field services, government contracting, and land and resource development areas. We're especially proud that of the top 10 privately owned Alaskan companies, we rank number one in the percentage of our employees corporation-wide who are Alaskans. So we're very, very committed to this state. And we hope to be for a long time in the future. Doyon Limited is a for-profit company, and we make money for our shareholders primarily based on two resources: one, natural resource development, and two, human resource development. So when last year we were exploring for natural gas in the Nanana Basin, we spent about $15 million exploring to develop that natural resource, very, very important for our state. That importance for our state was recognized by an incentive tax credit that the state has right now of 50% for that investment. Whereas, if we had invested, say, the same amount, $15 million in internships, scholarships, research programs, facilities, endowed chairs, workforce development programs, on and on and on and on, we would have received a $150,000 tax credit for that, a 1% tax credit. So what we're trying to do here really is put on balance the state's support for private sector investments in our human resources along with our natural resources. By enacting this bill, we believe you encourage businesses to invest in post-secondary education, from vocational technical programs to university programs. We believe you open up another revenue source for higher education, as you've heard Ms. Rutherford just testify. You strengthen the relationship between colleges and businesses, the businesses that hire the graduates of those programs. We believe that's a very important connection. And it really does encourage a long-term collaboration and support of economic development in our state. I would note also that we are one of 12 Alaska-based Native corporations, the regional corporations, and this effort here is among the highest priority for the corporations in their work right now with the University of Alaska. So with those comments, I very much appreciate your support and am happy to respond to any questions you may have this morning.
Okay, thank you. And I guess I just wanted to check. You talked about vocational education, and I'm seeing that this is for not only secondary school level vocational courses, but it's also for facilities so that those can be provided, and vocational education courses programs facilitated by a state operated vocational school, so that would be like AvTech or yes, any of those things, and also for facility by a nonprofit, public or private, Alaska 2-year or 4-year college accredited by Regional Accreditation Association. So I just wanted to make sure that that went out in, you know, on the record that this was both the university or any college that was accredited in the state, as well as any of these vocational programs. Sure, appreciate your willingness to invest in education, where this committee is investing a lot of time, but we really appreciate people that are willing to put their money forward as well. So, and that's what this bill is intended to encourage, we think. So I didn't have any further questions. Does anyone else? So thank you very much for coming and offering your testimony.
Appreciate it.
Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 367? Is there anyone online who would like to testify on 367? I guess I would like to ask Robin Wilson or Joanna Bales, Department of Revenue, whoever feels like that would be there. This is an expansion of the amount of tax credit that would be used to help leverage in more private funds. Does the Department of Revenue have concerns about the amount of tax credits that we would be offering?
Chair Seaton, for the record, this is Joanna Bales, the Deputy Director of the Tax Division.
Welcome, Joanna. And would you go ahead did you hear my question?
Yes, I did.
And
I can't really say that we have concerns. Obviously, if the legislature and the administration is interested in offering more tax credits to incentivize giving to our university and post-educational system, that's fine. I would like to point out, though, I mean, if you take a look at the fiscal note that we prepared, we did some quick analysis on this. It obviously is difficult for us to determine the exact amount of giving that this type of legislation would promote. However, we did take a look at our 2008 corporate income tax return filers and looked at actually all of those corporations individually and did a calculation. So if every one of the corporations took advantage of this piece of legislation to its fullest extent, we would have seen a drop of $200 million in our corporate income tax for that year. I didn't do that same analysis for the other tax types that this bill affects. This bill does affect the mining license tax, the fisheries business tax, and the fisheries resource landing tax, the oil and gas production and property taxes, as well as the insurance taxes. So just to point out that, you know, those are other areas where the tax credits could be applied. So that's basically, you know, really what our role is, just to let you know what the revenue impacts would be due to this legislation, or could potentially be. I'm not saying that all taxpayers would actually take advantage of the program. It's difficult to tell.
Sure, and that's looking at the at each corporation, at looking at a tax cap or a contribution cap of $25 million, but if they were a corporation that had a total tax liability of $400,000, then you just looked at their tax liability, right?
Chair Seaton, that's correct. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and can you tell us how much it currently, with the $150,000 for the first $200,000, what is our contribution in tax credits under the current law, the amount?
The number of the education credits that were claimed for our most recent filings, we had 16 taxpayers take advantage of it on the corporate side for approximately $1 million in tax credits. For insurance premiums tax, we had 3 taxpayers for $450,000 in credits. Fishery resource landing, $150,000 in tax credits. The business tax, another $450,000 in tax credits from 3 taxpayers, for a total of $2.1 million. We actually didn't have any taxpayers who took the credit against the oil and gas or the production or property tax. And the reason for that, and it would work the same way in the proposed legislation, is that you're limited. The $150,000, let's say if you are an oil and gas production tax, property tax, and corporate income tax payer, you can only take a total of $150,000 regardless of which tax type you claim the credit against.
Sure, and this would still maintain that separation, so you can only take it against one type of tax, is that correct?
That's correct. You could take $25 million total against what the combination of tax types for which you pay tax.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Does anybody else have any questions for the Department of Revenue? And I think I asked, did we have anybody else online to testify? Do we have anybody else in the audience to testify? Seeing none, I'll close public testimony on this, and we will put it aside and take it up on Friday, along with House Bill 350, and as then we have House Bill 393, alternative charter school funding, and we might get a introduction of the funding change pending introduction and referral for the Alaska Military Youth Academy. So with that, appreciate the committee and the public's participation, and we will be adjourned at 10:10.